Track 14, Breaking the Silence. Some survivors eventually disclose the abuse to people they trust, including relatives, close friends, family, physicians, and therapists. Breaking the silence refers to broader disclosure encompassing complaints to professional bodies, lawsuits, and public statements, as mentioned earlier. Anything that alerts the professions and the public to the common occurrence and tragic consequences of abuse by health professionals, to the occurrence and tragic consequences of the abuse by the mental health or health professionals. Breaking the silence is not for everyone, and it can be personally disastrous or contra-therapeutic, as you know. The old adage, the best revenge is a good life, depending on the client's needs, may be the best strategy here. As mentioned earlier, breaking the silence is made difficult by a number of factors, including survivors' feelings, community attitudes, and lack of support, the self-protective stance of the health professions, and the idiosyncrasies of the legal system. Emotions that obstruct survivors' desire to break the silence include shame, self-doubt, and fear. The problems created by sexual abuse, including pervasive self-doubts about their own judgment, perceptions, and motivations, combined with shame and self-blame, to make a complaint or disclosure seem impossible. As mentioned earlier, who wants to confess publicly that he or she has been duped or used? Quite rightly, the survivor fears the consequences of disclosure. They hear tales of husbands divorcing patients' wives, of children being taken away, and of their humiliating sexual secrets being made public. Most survivors are angry with the health or mental health profession and reluctant to trust boards of inquiry and committees that consist of other professionals who work in the same field. Still struggling with guilt about their own complicity and lingering positive feelings towards the professional, some survivors hesitate to take the step that may cause the offending health professional pain or even damage his or her career. Michaels believes that victim thinking can be tracked to one of the following four common patterns of thinking that emerge during the actual trauma and during secondary wounding experiences. Ask yourself if you have observed these four patterns in your abuse survivors. 1. The person cannot tolerate mistakes in himself or others. 2. Personal difficulties are denied. 3. Black and white thinking prevails. 4. Survival tactics are continued. Because of the severe damage often sustained by people who are sexually abused by mental health professionals and the frequency of secondary wounding experiences is high, immersed in a desire for revenge or compassion, lacking community and family support, unable or unwilling to get therapist help, still struggling with PTSD symptoms, they may be unable to transcend the victim identity and unable to get on with their lives. Here's an example of what I stated to Mary as she was in this breaking the silence stage. There is no such thing as resolving your trauma issues and being done with your past in general. For the truly traumatized, there is no forgetting, and no amount of therapy or mind control can protect you from traumatic memories, feelings, and conflicts coming back into your life. However, if you have never really attended to the trauma, if your trauma process work has been half-hearted or incomplete, then your present-day life is saddled with the major burden, the issues from your traumatic past with which you have not dealt. If you haven't spent adequate time dealing with the trauma and are trying to suspend or minimize what happened to you, then you are spending your energy fighting yourself, and I like to be frank with my clients. If this is the case, it's no wonder that you are exhausted and have little energy for other people. Most of your energy goes to keeping the trauma in denial or repression and managing your symptoms so they don't get out of control and cause an economic or emotional disaster. Essentially, you are spending your time and strength trying to pretend the trauma never happened, or trying to convince yourself that it wasn't that important, and of course you can handle it, and the emotions and issues that it raises. Of course you can handle it and the emotions and issues that it raised all by yourself. Regarding breaking the silence, Kenneth Pope states the tendency of licensing boards and bodies to assume that perpetrators can be rehabilitated. Pope suggests that this may support a deep and chronic sense of special entitlement among therapists. In other professions, Pope maintains sexual offenders would not be allowed to return to their job in contact with the population that they had abused. A good example of this is found in the conflict within the Catholic Church. Pope feels allowing a perpetrator to resume a limited therapy practice, he points out, such as seeing only male patients, ignores the more fundamental issues of abusing a position of the balance of power and trust. Pope draws attention to a case where a psychiatrist was prohibited from treating females and stresses that such interventions do little to address the underlying failures of self-management that characterize patient-client sexual contact. He feels there is a failure to focus on the development of a therapeutic alliance essential for the treatment process. Pope states a concern that a clinician who cannot be considered competent to treat women should be considered competent to treat men. Pope feels licensing boards need a great deal of education to make them aware that sexual abuse of clients, like other varieties of sexual assault, are not just about sex. Other dimensions, such as the balance of power differential between mental health professions and the client, the mystique and special entitlement accorded to mental health professionals mentioned earlier, the breach of trust and fiduciary duty, the lack of caring, empathy, and concern, as well as other personality and situational factors, are all involved. Pope feels if mental health professionals who sexually abuse clients are allowed to be returned to practice, they should have a lengthy period of monitoring and supervision, as there is little evidence that rehabilitation plans are effective, and literature indicates the recidivism rate is high. Question 14. What are some feelings an abuse survivor experiences to deter him or her from informing others? This CD has primarily explored balancing power concerning the violation of the personal contact boundary by therapists regarding their clients. As mentioned at the beginning of this CD set, the Institute selected this topic as a result of a survey conducted of professional licensure boards in several states. The boards were asked what ethical area they would select as being of the greatest priority. We as therapists would like to think that mental health professionals taking sexual advantage of their clients is not a problem. However, as indicated in this CD series, when a client comes to you with allegations of sexual impropriety, hopefully this knowledge base will be of assistance to you. Topics covered have been rationalizations, attitude assessment exercise, the power imbalance, client hurdles, the normal imbalance of power, warning signs, risk factors, exploitive therapy relationships, how the shift occurs, parallels with other forms of abusive relationships, realization of the truth, intervention techniques, facilitating healing, and breaking the silence. Thank you for your purchase of this home study course. It is hoped that this learning experience will prove to be a valuable one for you, and you received information that enhances your professional growth. This is Catherine Appleton. Talk to you again in another home study course.